Shalom, everybody. Welcome back to the second part of the Rites of Passage. As you remember, we were going over in the first part of the series, we were talking about how the rites function. And remember, there's three separate parts of this transition from a new time, or old time, old man, and whatnot, into the new time, or the new man, new place, and things like that. And when we split those up, we split them up into three different sections. And I hope you went online and you can print out this. This will really help you throughout the teaching as you can look at each one of these parts here. But just as a quick review, remember the rites of separation were separating you off from the old person. It was symbolic of death and rebirth. Symbology was there. Oftentimes there's purification from the old self and leaving the old ways. And then you move into that transition phase, which remember lasted for 7 days, typically, but not always. But typically when we see 7 days, we can kind of start to think maybe this is a rite of passage. And remember, this was a training period, and with any good training comes trials, tribulation, and testing, right? Because you're making sure that the person who's being trained is actually properly adjusting. And the whole purpose of the transitional phase was preparation to incorporate into that new person, that new role, that new part in society, or whatever else. And remember, they were typically separated out from society, and they were kind of in a state of ambiguity. They weren't, you're not exactly who you used to be, but you're not who you're going to be in the future. You're kind of in this in-between role. And then lastly, of course, you have the rites of incorporation. You have specific things that actually incorporate you into who you will be. And oftentimes this would include a sacrifice and some sort of a method of consecrating you into that new role. And remember, the purpose for all of these was to set clear boundaries between one thing and another. So there was no, it was either hot or cold, right? There was no kind of lukewarm, you don't know what you are, except for, of course, in that transitional phase. But those rites of separation and the rites of incorporation clearly define this person, these social boundaries, which are very important, as we'll be able to see here. Defining the difference between a normal Israelite and a priest, right? Or as even more importantly, a Levite and a priest, right? Remember the rebellion of the sons of Korach, right? He rebelled because he wanted to step into a role which he hadn't gone through the passage for, because he wasn't allowed to, of course, but he was trying to step into that role. So moving on here, what we're going to do in part two is we're going to really look at, especially into the Torah, and maybe a little bit of other stuff in the Tanakh, but I want to make it clear in your mind that this isn't something that we just kind of have come up with and now we're trying to force into the text. I want to show that there's a legal precedent set throughout Torah so that we can then understand this is an established legal means by Yahweh of taking a person from being the old person to the new person. And then we're going to be able to take that into the first century writings, and especially into Paul's writings, and we're going to really be able to open up and understand a lot of things. We'll be able to clearly see which phase he's talking about, especially in relationship, our relationship with the Torah. He's not saying that the Torah is done away with. He's just putting the Torah in the proper place within these rites of passage. So it's really going to be extremely exciting. When we get to part three of this video, I really hope that you'll be enlightened. I've been very enlightened, and it's really opened my eyes up to Paul's writings, especially, but all throughout the first century of the New Testament writings. So let's get right on in and start to show the legal precedents that occurred in the Tanakh. Now, we'll just go ahead and we will start off with Adam and Chava. Remember when, right after they sinned, they were suddenly going to be kicked out of the garden. So they went from, and this is kind of reverse, most of the time with rites of passage, you're going from a lower status, to a higher status. But this with Adam and Chava being kicked out of the garden, they were going from an elevated status, that of immortality, to a sort of divinity almost, right? And they were going to a lowly mortal state where they would have hardships, the earth would no longer bear fruit with ease, there would be pain in childbirth. And so there had to be a transitional phase. So if you look at it, what happens to them? They're stripped of their garments, right? This text says that they noticed that they were naked. And before, the word there that was used is different from the word later on in Genesis 3 that's used for naked. And I've covered this in past series. The word in Genesis 2 that's used means partially naked, not shamefully nudity, and that's oftentimes where they're described with garments of light. And so what we see here is after the fall, God essentially strips them of this, whatever it was that was keeping their eyes from seeing their nudity. And so that was separating them out from that. Then they had to go through the transitional phase. And remember, the transition is where we have the teachings and the trials and testing. So God gives them, he goes through the covenant lawsuit with them. That was a trial and testing to see how they would properly respond, which of course we know that they didn't. They actually kept on shifting the blame there. They went through a covenant lawsuit, and then there was curses and instructions, just like in a transitional phase. And eventually they were incorporated into the new life. They were kicked out of the garden, but they were given garments of clothing in order to of animal skin in order to incorporate them into that new world. The next thing that we come to, and we can kind of see this in the life of Noah, right, with separating the old world, the world that was pre-flood or pre-deluge, to antediluvian, or the post flood world. It wasn't just an immediate thing. There was the waters came down, right, and they separated out all of that other life. They washed it away. They purified the old world, and there was a transitional phase, right? The 40 days of rain followed by, I think it was like 150 days or something like that on the ark, and then they finally get to the new earth. And what is the first thing? As soon as they get out of the ark, what does Noah do? He offers a sacrifice to incorporate, to consecrate the new world back to Yahweh. So right there we have a clear distinction of the rites of passage. Avraham, if you remember Avraham, what is he told to do? He lives in Mesopotamia, which is way up to the northeast of where Israel, the land of Canaan, is. And he's told to separate, to leave his family. He has to leave everything that he had. And if we look at some of the, I believe it's the book of Yasher, it talks about he was actually a very well-to-do man. His father was an idol maker, and I believe his father was a general in the army of the king of that time. I can't think of his name all of a sudden. Anyways, so he has to separate out from that lifestyle. That's why God says, "Leave your family." Let's just go there real fast. Let's go to Genesis 12 here. And we can see it says, "And Yahweh said to Avraham, go yourself out of your land and to your relatives from your father's house to a land which I will show you." Right? So right there, we have a separation. He said, go out from your land, separate from your land and your relatives, and go to a place where I will show you. So he separates, and then there's that transitional period. He walks to the land of Canaan. He walks by faith with El Shaddai, right? And even when he gets to the land, he's still kind of in a transitional phase. What is the next thing that happens? He gets into the land, and down in, I think further down here in verse 12, yep, and further down in verse 12, it talks about he has to go down to the land of Egypt, to Mitzrayim, because of there's a famine in the land. So as soon as he gets there, things don't just start going well for him. He isn't immediately incorporated into this absolute blessing that God has promised him. He has to go through testing and trials. He has to learn to walk by faith, right? He's in that transitional period. And, of course, we know the outcome with that. And it's kind of interesting, because what happens when he finally starts to actually get incorporated in, when we go to Genesis 15, he has to go through the covenant of the pieces. Let me see if I can find this. I forgot to look for the exact thing here. But If you look in the Threshold Covenant by Henry Clay Trumbull, he talks about starting page 185, Hebrew Passover or crossover sacrifice. He talks about this, the importance of these sacrifices in crossing over into the threshold of a new house, but it's also talking about passing over into a new land here. And we can see clearly that's, you know, as once Abraham gets incorporated into this new land, we have Genesis 15 where he's put to sleep. And it's kind of interesting because he's put to sleep, and it's actually God who goes through that incorporation rites for him. Or as I personally believe, I believe it was Yeshua who walked through those pieces so that Yeshua was able to, of course, then be the one who took the penalty for rebellion for the nation of Israel. And that's what gave him that legal right. But that's, you know, that's also what's given Abraham that incorporation into Israel. And it kind of went even further because what happens next? After that, in chapter 16, we have the episode with Hagar, a little bit more trials and testing. And then we have the covenant of circumcision, right? The circumcision was given, which is very clearly seen as a rite of incorporation, not just in the Bible, but also in the ancient Near East. Other nations used circumcision as well. Now, they typically would actually perform circumcision before a marriage, which, if you remember in, this was a question I couldn't understand. Remember in Exodus 4, where Moshe is returning from Jethro, he's going back to Egypt, and he's going along the way, and suddenly Yahweh sought to kill him because he hadn't circumcised his son. It just made, you know, no sense. Why does Zipporah say, "You're a bridegroom of blood to me"? That made no sense to me. Well, now that I understand the cultures and the customs in those times, they would actually circumcise the people right before the marriage. The man would become circumcised as part of an incorporation into that marriage. And so that was most likely the customs from where Zipporah was that the man would be circumcised at that point in time. But of course, Moses had been circumcised well before that because he was a Hebrew, most likely. And actually, it never tells us when Moses was circumcised. I didn't even think about that, but that would be kind of interesting idea there. But anyways, Moses, his son hadn't been circumcised, and so as Zipporah circumcises the son, that's kind of showing this whole concept of bridegroom and marriage in there. And there's a whole lengthy discussion there that we won't go into because of time purposes, of course. Anyways, so the next really big one, and we'll spend a little bit of time here because this is a very important one to remember, is the Passover. And the reason why it's so important is, remember what Paul talks about is that the things that were written in the Torah were written for our admonition. And most of us in the Hebrew Roots movement, we've come to understand that the Torah is kind of, you know, that the whole Exodus experience is kind of a roadmap for our personal spiritual lives. But not only that, but we realize that there's going to be a second Exodus, and it's going to follow the pattern of the first Exodus. So it's very important to see how these rites of passage work with the Passover. Now, the first thing I want to draw your attention to is the word Passover itself. We can look here, the Hebrew word is Pesach, right? So let's look here in 1 Kings. Let's see where I wanted to look at here. 1 Kings, and this is 1 Kings 18, verse 21. And this is where, remember, Elijah was having this confrontation with the prophets of Baal because of the sins of the Israelites. And so they get into this confrontation, and let's go down here to verse 18, verse 21. And Elijah says, to the people, how long will you waver between two opinions? If the, you know, let me go back to the English here. Sorry about this. Eliyahu came to all the people and said, how long will you keep hopping between two opinions? If Yahweh is Elohim, follow him. If Baal, follow him. But the people answered him not a word. Now we go back here and we look in the Hebrew, and it's kind of interesting that the scriptures label it as hopping between two opinions, because that's actually a much better translation. The King James says waver between two opinions, I believe. So let's look here, and we can see Al Shati Ha Saifim. It's H6452. You can see right here on the screen, the word is Pasach, right? The same Hebrew word that's used for Passover. And it's from a primitive root. It means to hop, that is figuratively skip over, by implication to hesitate, also literal dance, halt, leap, pass over. Right? It means to come and you actually pass over the doorway. That's the meaning of it. And it's kind of, and the word is literally describing that threshold that you're going over. It's that moment as you're stepping between the threshold, or the outside world and inside world, and you're hovering over the threshold there. And remember what we talked about right in the beginning is that's exactly what the rites of passage were. It's that transitioning. It's the idea of going from the outside world to the inside world, and in between you have to go over the doorway. And at one point in time, you're kind of partially in one world and partially in another world. That's exactly what the whole concept of Pesach is, Passover. And so we can look at the Passover itself, the Passover all the way, because what happened? At Passover, they separated out from Egypt, right? They no longer were Egyptian slaves. But in the meantime, who were they? We don't, you know, they were kind of an ambiguous state in between until they get to Mount Sinai and they're given the Torah. And as we've understood here and as we've studied into in past series, the Torah was an ancient Near Eastern suzerainty treaty which made them vassal kings to the great king, to Yahweh, right? So they went from slavery to being kings. And what happened in between? There was, of course, a transitional period. So let's break it down and let's look at all the different parts here. The first thing was the rites of separation. What did they have to do? They had to put the lamb's blood on the doorpost. Now this is really interesting because this isn't something that we see in the Torah, but we know that by looking into the culture, that in their doorposts, we've actually found, you know, actual doorposts from that time period. And in these doorposts, they would actually either have idols like put into the doorposts, or they would have carvings all around their doorposts, right, of these idolatrous things. And so by wiping the blood on the lintels of their doorposts, they're putting the blood of that lamb, purifying their household from all that idolatry. What was the next commandment? They're told, you put the lamb's blood on the doorpost, which is a purification of your household. And then the other big thing with Passover was they were told not to eat leaven. Now, why not eat leaven? Well, because in the ancient Near East, in Egypt, they worshipped a god called Osiris, right? And it was either the first of Nisan, or actually it might have actually even been on Nisan 14th when they would worship this pig, or this god Osiris. And the way that the Egyptians would do it was they would actually cook a pig and they would eat it. And this was the only time the entire year they would eat pig was on this specific day when they would sacrifice this pig to their god. Kind of reminds me of some of these holidays that are kept now that seem to have, you know, the Yule ham, the Christmas ham, the Easter ham. Kind of interesting connection there, right? So they would sacrifice this pig and they would eat it. Now, if you were too poor to be able to afford a pig, like, say, the Hebrews, because they were slaves, what would they do? If they couldn't afford a pig, they would bake cakes with leaven and honey in them, and they would eat these cakes in honor of Osiris. Well, what does God say? You are going to separate out from Egypt. You are no longer going to be idolatrous, so you are going to take a seven-day period, rites of passage, right? And you're going to separate out, you're going to cut off leaven from all of your dwellings during this passage time because you're separating out from this idolatrous life of slavery in Egypt. And then they do that, they plunder Egypt, and they go through a giant mikvah, right? They go right through the Red Sea. So once again, another purification thing, which is, once again, remember that the mikvah is symbolic of death and rebirth. And that's exactly what happened with Israel. As they're going down through there, it's as if they're dying through the pits of the sea. Because remember, in the ancient Near East, they actually believed that the sea was the gateway to Sheol, to hell. And so they go down to Sheol and they come up. It is a rebirth. They overcame that trial by ordeal and they've been purified now. And now they are no longer those slaves in Egypt. And so the next phase they would move into then is the rites of transition. So how can we show that they were truly in the rites of transition? Well, what happened between the Red Sea and Mount Sinai? They had a journey. And what happened during that journey? We've got several different trials. We had the trial by bitter waters. Remember where they had the bitter waters at Meribah, I believe it was. They had the trial of keeping the Shabbat. Remember God gave them the manna, and they were to take a double portion for the Shabbat. So that was, in essence, they were taught about the Shabbat, and then they were given trials and testing to see if they would actually keep the Shabbat by gathering double the amount of manna on the sixth day. They remember the first time that they cried out to Moshe that they were thirsty, and he struck the rock. That was another trial for them. They had the battle of Amalek. That was another trial. And then, of course, Moses was being overwhelmed, so he himself had that overwhelming trial, which Jethro helped him out and showed him how to become that leader. So clearly, there was training and there was trials. And remember, God really didn't hold them that accountable between that point in time and when they get to Mount Sinai. He didn't, if memory serves me, no one got put to death for any of that grumbling. He didn't punish them for that. He never brings those things up. He only brings up stuff that happened after the giving of the Torah. And then they get to Mount Sinai, and they're now to be incorporated into their new life as worshipers of Yahweh, but also as vassal kings unto the great King Yahweh. And so as they get to the mountain, they are told to perform a mikvah. Remember in Exodus 19, they're told, he said, wash your clothes and prepare yourself, separate yourself out from your wives for 3 days prior to approaching this mountain. Right? Because that's what they were about to do. They're about to be incorporated. And so once again, there's another purification that happens with incorporation oftentimes. The mountain itself was actually separated. They set boundaries on it. Right? And if you actually look at the mountain itself was set up kind of like in this whole concept of rites of passage. You have the plains where you have Israel, and you have the top of the mountain where God dwells, where only Moses is ever allowed to come up there. But then there's an intermediate zone there where there's boundaries set where no one could cross except for Moses and the 70 elders and Aaron and Joshua, right? They had those three stages with that, the pound, this is the physical world, and the top of the mountain was essentially the other world, the spiritual world, the world where Yahweh himself dwells. And so there had to be a transition zone where, remember, they celebrated the covenant by the ratifying of the covenant by eating a meal in that boundary zone. Just like between countries, how they would have like the DMZ between North and South Korea. Remember how we were talking about that? They have that boundary zone between the two countries, and that's where battles are fought, but that's also where rituals were performed, where if they were going to do some sort of a meeting between the heads of state, they would come out there and they would do all sorts of rituals. And so that's the exact way the mountain itself was set up. So God gives them the suzerainty treaty and makes them he was about to make them vassal kings. But what happens? The incident with the golden calf, the worshiping of the golden calf. And so what happened because of that, because remember, they were still in that trial and testing phase, and this was essentially their final test, and they failed their final test. Most of them did. And so what happened to them is a term that I was very familiar with in boot camp, because remember I was talking about how boot camp is very similar, or it is a rite of passage. In boot camp, they called it ASMO. If you got up to a certain week and you in your testing phase, you messed up, they would ASMO you, which would mean they'd take you from where you are and they'd send you back 2 weeks, or they might even send you all the way back to the beginning. You'd go to a different company, you'd start over, essentially. You're having to go through all the whole process again. What happened to Israel? They made it all the way there. They were about to become a nation of priests, and they failed. They failed the final test. They failed to wait for Moses to come down, and they started worshiping the image of a beast. And so they were sent back, essentially, in their spiritual, or in their process of becoming a kingdom of priests. However, there was one tribe that did pass the test. Who was that? The Levites, remember? The Levites passed the test because they stood up for Yahweh's righteousness, and they were not afraid to go out and kill all of their brothers who had participated in the golden calf. And so they were actually incorporated into God's ideal kingdom, right? God desires all of us to become like priests. And that's what the Levites were. The Levites were all like priests. Not all the Levites were priests, but all the priests were Levites, right? And my belief is that had Israel never had worshipped that golden calf, they would have become a nation of priests, and the firstborn, the representative of each family, would have gone on to be an officiating priest, but all of them would have had that higher holy status. Remember that the Levites were at a higher level of holiness. They weren't at the common level. They had an elevated status of holiness, and that's what God always desired for his nation to be, and yet we as a people could not keep our eyes from turning to other gods. And so we see that same pattern. This is the pattern that goes on in all of our lives. We go through these trials and testings, and we pass them. God incorporates us in to the main body of believers, and not to say that that we need to judge people, but in our own personal walk, we need to realize that when we pass the test that he's going to put in our way, he's going to incorporate us in and give us that higher level of responsibility, give us a role in his kingdom with something to do. So we've got to always be diligent in making sure that we are always following the Torah and keeping his precepts and his principles and his laws, because this is how we get incorporated into that bigger that body, that Levitical priesthood, the level of higher holiness, right? Where he gives us a role, he gives us a function in the kingdom that we can perform now. And I hope this is making sense to you. We can also see, now that they failed that, and I believe that had they passed that, they would have been taken to the promised land, because they really weren't that far. They really didn't need to go 40 years, right? But they did end up going 40 years because they failed that. They got reset, essentially. So as that set them back to that phase where they had just been separated, and now they have to go through that transitional period. And so now they had to go through 40 years of trials and tribulations. And we know that only two of them actually made it all the way through, two of the ones who were 20 and older. And it's kind of interesting, because we can always, and this is a pattern throughout the rites of passage, is that there's always a lot of emphasis and discussion on the rites of separation on that beginning and on the end, the rites of transition, but there's really not a lot of whole discussion or anything. You're just in that ambiguous state during the transitional phase, and usually there's not a lot recorded about that. That makes perfect sense now for the Torah, because the Torah, it's has a heavy emphasis on what happened right at the beginning. It has, you know, the Passover, the Mount Sinai, the initial trials and testing, and then it's just kind of like glosses over and skips all the way to the end in the narrative portion. And then you have the things that happen in the end, but we don't really have much of a description about what went on for 40 years in between there. Why is that? Because this is a rite of passage. This is a text that's recording this. And so that period was just assumed that you understood that they were just spending that time learning how to walk in Torah, going through various trials and testings until they could finally be incorporated. And the biggest incorporation for Israel wasn't just to become vassal kings, but was that to actually own land. They weren't full, what's the way to put this? They hadn't come into the full promise of Elohim until they were actually in the land, until they actually owned part of the land. The covenant that was made with Abraham 430 years earlier, was not fulfilled until they got into the land, right? And of course, we know there's a lot more that went on to with fulfilling that, because they never actually took the entire land, so they've never even really fulfilled that covenant with Abraham. But that was that incorporation. That's why when they were about to go into the land, what did they do again? They had another purification. They crossed through the River Jordan, and they had a covenant renewal ceremony at Mount Gerizim and Mount Ebal. So that's kind of a broad picture of the entire Torah being a rite of passage. Now we can that was the macroscopic, and we can take microscopic look and look at various parts throughout the Torah to see very clearly these rites of passage. And this is actually where I first noticed this and started researching why there was this pattern. And that's when I discovered the book by Arnold van Gennep and several other books that have really been just absolutely amazing for me in my research. I noticed this with the priesthood and with the purification of the Metzorah, the ex-leper. They have these periods of 7 days in there. Right, we'll start off in Exodus 29, and it's also in Leviticus 8 and 9, and various other part, and also in Numbers, I believe. I can't remember exactly, but it talks about how they were the Aaron and his sons were induced into the priesthood, right? And when we look at them, we can see a pattern very clearly emerging. If you go to Exodus 29. It says, "In this ye shall task them to do, to set them apart, to serve me as priests. You take a young bull and two rams, perfect one, unleavened bread, unleavened cakes, mixed with oil, and unleavened wafers, anointed with oil, and make these of wheat flour. And you shall put them in one basket, and bring them in a basket along with the bull and the two rams. And you shall bring Aharon and his sons to the door of the tent of meeting, and wash them with water." So you take them to the threshold of the tent of meeting, because remember, the threshold is where those rituals were performed. And we'll talk about this in a little bit, but the tabernacle itself is set up as this same sort of passage, rite of passage sort of thing, where you have the courtyard being this world and the Holy of Holies being the other world, and therefore the doorway into the tabernacle and the holy place in the tabernacle were that liminal zone or that transitional zone, which is basically a place that where heaven and earth essentially are meeting, and that's where the rituals were performed. That's why they had to take the animals to slaughter them to the door of the tent of meeting, to take them into that transitional zone. And that's why he takes Aharon and his sons to the door of the tent of meeting, and then he washes them with water, purifying off that oldness, and he places garments on them, which, once again, it separates them out from who they were and puts them into the role that they will be going into. So they wash them with water, they anoint them with oil, Then they have that transitional phase where and it's 7 days long, and it never tells us what were they doing during those 7 days. Well, it's kind of obvious, you know, when you think about it, they had to be learning how to perform the sacrifices. And in fact, when you look at the structure of Leviticus, that's what most people believe, is that the laws concerning sacrifice in Leviticus 1 through 7 were actually given, so that those were given prior to Aaron and his sons going into the priesthood, so that they, during those 7 days, they would be learning, trial and testing, how to actually perform their function as the priesthood. And this was actually considered like a very dangerous state, because, you know, during this time period, what happens if they mess up? You know, you're kind of in this state of ambiguity where you have the commandments and you're trying to learn them, but what happens if you mess up? How many of you feel like that today? You're learning the Torah, you're learning the commandments, but what happens if you mess up? We don't know. We're in that transitional phase, right? We're learning, we're going through trials and testing, and eventually we will be incorporated in. And this is exactly where Aharon and his sons are. And then at the end, we have, they purify the altar, they purify the priest. Remember that they take Aaron and his sons and they put blood on his earlobe, on the right thumb, and on the right toe. They consecrate the altar. They actually index, and you can go and you can see my blood manipulation teaching for more information on this whole process with the induction and the priesthood. But they index them to the altar, and they have this, you know, now they have this clothing. And that's another thing that I covered this in the hem and garment teaching, is that clothing wasn't just like, hey, you know, you get this free t-shirt saying I passed the priesthood ritual. You get your clothing represented who you were. And so when they put on this clothing, it represented that they were in their official status. They were actually priests. They became a new person. They were no longer sons of Levi. They were now priests. Still ancestors, or their ancestors were sons of Levi, but they were Kohanim. They were at a new occupation, essentially. So what we also see this exact same thing happening. And in fact, with the Metzorah, the ex-leper, this is the only time that blood was actually ever placed on an individual Israelite. And I'm going to go into this in the future, and that I had initially intended to do a teaching on Messiah, the leper, the leper Messiah. And that's where I stumbled across this, and so I wanted to do this first. So we'll go a lot more in depth in the future on the purification of the leper and how that all ties in with our walk and what Messiah did for us. But we can look at the Torah and throughout the Bible, and we can see that leprosy is connected with actual Ma'al. And you can look, Daniel McGurr has some great teachings he's doing on the subject of Ma'al that I highly recommend you go out and you look and you see what Ma'al is. But in a nutshell, Ma'al is a sin against God, and it's a very serious offense. And so this leprosy was actually seen as a Ma'al, as a sin against God, questioning his authority especially. And when you look at, I think it's in Numbers 15, I can't remember the exact verse right off the top of my head, but everyone should know it. It's when Aaron and Miriam, they question Moses' authority. Suddenly Miriam is stricken with leprosy, and so Moshe has to pray for her, and he prays, let her not be stricken like a stillborn child with its flesh peeling off. And that was the concept behind leprosy, was that the person looked like a corpse. They were alive, but they looked like a corpse. They looked like the Walking Dead. You know, they weren't going, oh, you know, trying to eat your flesh or anything like we have in Hollywood today. But I believe the whole concept of zombies came out of this leprosy. And we know that it wasn't actually leprosy. It was more of a skin disease. But that whole idea of the Walking Dead, the zombies, I believe came from this concept of leprosy, which is where they have these spots and it looked to other people, it looked like they were a corpse, looked like they were dead. And so they're going from being dead, and now they've been cured. And if you look in the Bible, only God cures lepers. In any recorded account, we don't have any recorded accounts of lepers just overcoming the disease. Every account that's recorded, God himself is the one who cured them. Now, it could have been through a proxy, through the prophet, right? But it was through God's power that they were cured of this leprosy. And so they're going from being a dead person, and now, and remember, they had to be outside the camp. So they're dead, and it's a picture of being outside of covenant. And this is all, this whole stuff with leprosy is all a huge picture. It's the idea of being dead and outside of covenant to being restored back to covenant. And so when we go to Leviticus 14, we see the ritual there. And it says, "And Yahweh spoke to Moshe, saying, 'This is the Torah of the leper for the day of his cleansing. He's brought to the priest, and the priest shall go outside the camp, and the priest shall look and see if his leprosy is healed in the leper, and the priest shall command, he shall take for him who is to be cleansed two live and clean birds, and cedar wood and scarlet and hyssop. And the priest shall command, he shall kill one of the birds over an earthen vessel over running water. Let him take the live bird and the cedar wood and scarlet and hyssop and dip them and the live bird in the blood of the bird that was killed over running water. And he shall sprinkle it seven times on him who is to be cleansed from leprosy, and shall pronounce him clean, and shall let the live bird loose in an open field. He who is cleansed shall wash his garments, and shall shave off all his hair, and wash himself with water, and shall be clean. Then he comes into the camp, but must stay outside of his tent for 7 days. He's going to go through that transitional phase now. And on the seventh day, he shaves off all his hair, and his beard, and his eyebrows, and even shaves his even all his hair he shaves off, and he shall wash his garments, again, wash his body in water, and shall be clean. And then on the eighth day, he is then allowed to be, that's when they actually daub the blood on his earlobe, and they anoint his head with oil. So what is this doing? He's separating out from being that dead person. He's been cured of the disease, but now he has to be ritually cleansed of that impurity, because this is, and we'll talk about this in future series, but there's graded levels of holiness and there's graded levels of impurity. And the leper is at the most impure state you can be in. He's corpse contaminated. So he has to be cleansed, this scape bird, essentially. I mean, it's essentially like the scapegoat on Yom Kippur. It's, the ritual is very similar. And we also see the cedar wood, scarlet, and hyssop are the same materials that are used with the red heifer, which is used to cure people of corpse impurity, right? So all these things are combined in order to remove this heavy layer of defilement that's so defiling, if he's even in the same room as you, you would become defiled because of him. And he has to wash his clothes, he has to shave, and all that. So he's separating out. And then there's this seven-day period where he's hanging out in the camp, but he can't go inside his tent. So what's going on there? He's transitioning. He's incorporating. He's preparing to incorporate, because he's been living outside the camp so long. Now he gets to live inside the camp, but he can't be a full incorporated in, a full member of the camp yet. And then finally he goes through purification again. And now it doesn't state it, but it kind of implies it after that 7 days, he can go into his house, but he can't yet go to the temple. He has to be incorporated. He actually has to be reincorporated back into covenant life. And it's kind of interesting. If you go to the Mishnah, I don't have it pulled up right now. I believe it's Negaim 14.9. Let me see if I have that pulled up over here real fast. And once again, I'm not saying that the Mishnah has any authority, but we can use it as a point of reference to see how things were done. Yeah, it's Mishnah Tractate Negaim 14.9. And this is talking about the purification of the leper. He would, after this, on this eighth day, he would come to the temple, and they would have him go to, which gate was it? I believe it was the Nicanor gate. He would go to the Nicanor gate, in order to be purified. And what he would do is he would actually stand there at the threshold to the temple, and he, it says, the leper puts his head in, so he puts his head through the Nicanor gate, crosses that threshold, and actually, I mean, he's really on the threshold, essentially, and the priest will wipe blood on his ear, right? And then he puts his hand in, and the priest wipes blood on his thumb, and then he puts his foot in, and the priest wipes the blood on his great toe. Now, I know there was another rabbi who says he puts all of them, all three in together at the same time. But it's, the point is, it's really interesting, is they actually make him go to that transitional place between the outside world where the Gentiles were secluded to, and the gateway there where basically only the ger and the stranger and the Israelite could come into. And he puts all his stuff there, and they wipe the blood there in that transitional phase, and then he can finally enter. Now he's reincorporated back into covenant, and he's completely purified, and he's actually now allowed privileges to go into the temple. Because remember, that was a privilege. The whole concept of a temple isn't about sin and death. The whole concept of a temple is that's where God dwells, and if you want to communicate with God, that's where you go. You go to the temple for communication. It's a place that establishes communication between yourself and God, and between Israel, more importantly. Now, let's go onto the screen here, and we can actually see this whole thing here. And this is actually from the book Culture and Communication by Leach. He has a very similar diagram, I believe. But as you can see here, we've got these circles that represent different places. And this is essentially where I was talking about with the Nicanor Gate. You have this overlapping period. This right here would be the threshold, right? And so he went from the unclean world to the physically clean world. So now that leper could go from here, and he could enter into this area. Now, of course, that's as far as he can go. The priests, on the other hand, they're allowed to, depending on who they are, they're allowed to actually come into this zone. Now here, this area here represents the courtyard. This is the physically clean world. This is the world where Israel essentially dwells at on an everyday level. They try to dwell in this place. And over here, we've got the spiritual world, the Holy of Holies. You could essentially say this represented heaven. That's why the priest, the high priest, he actually had to go through a rite of passage. He had to be purified on the first day, the third day, and the seventh day before he could enter into this area. Otherwise, he would be killed. In rabbinic tradition, they had actually tie a rope around his ankle, because if he messed up when he entered into this world here, he could die. Now, this liminal zone, and remember that liminal zone, that was like that's essentially kind of like the DMZ between the different countries. This is where all the rituals are performed, and this would be the holy place, it would also include that door of the tent of meeting, but it include the holy place, and then also the altar, because only the priests were allowed to sprinkle blood on the altar. The individuals or the Levites could kill the animal, but only the priests were allowed to sprinkle blood on the altar, and only the priests were allowed to actually go up on the altar to offer these gifts, right? And so that was the liminal zone. And so, I mean, it's very interesting to understand these concepts here and to see how they are played out. And we'll talk about this more in the future. In the future, I'd like to do another whole teaching on the tabernacle itself, and really look at the tabernacle and the temple, and show you just how important they are, and how vital they are, and why we should consider it a blessing, not a curse, of the temple being built in the millennial kingdom. When Yeshua comes and builds the temple, you know, a lot of times, because people don't understand the function of a temple, or a function of a tabernacle, they tend to think that it's all about sin and death, but that's not what it was about. Psalms 132 tells you, David is saying, how can I have a palace and I have not built a resting place for you, talking to God, That's what a temple was. It was a place where God dwelt among his people. And that's what God always wanted to do, was dwell among his people. And if he has, I mean, just like a king doesn't go out, a king doesn't live in the house next door to you. The king lives in a castle, and even within the castle, he lives in the palace inside the castle. That's the same concept. Yahweh is our king, and he wants to dwell in a place that we can all see and go, wow, that is where God dwells. Getting a little bit off subject there, but it really is an amazing thought process there when you really think about that. Also, as I've talked about in the past, the calendar itself was actually, the whole thing was rites of passage, right? And we have the spring feasts and we have the fall feasts. In the spring feasts, we have a seven-day period. You have Passover, and the day after is a holy convocation, and then 7 days later, you have another holy convocation. And it's kind of interesting, on the third day in, depending on how you calculate it out, but I personally believe that Yeshua rose on Yom HaBikurim, the day of first fruits, which clearly was 3 days. You know, he died and resurrected 3 days later. Now, some people don't believe this, and that's okay, but I believe that he died and he was resurrected on that third day that I believe was the day of first fruits, which is interesting because what happens? The priests, they have to purify themselves on the first day, the third day, and the seventh day. And we can also see this in Numbers, where's that? Numbers 31. After the battle, they had to come back and they had to purify themselves on the first day, the third day, and the seventh day. Same concept there. And I believe that's why Yeshua died and resurrected on that third day. I believe that's all in connection with that. But anyways, the rites of passage had a calendar associated, or the calendar had everything to do with the rites of passage. And if we can look here on the screen, we can see what's going on. We're going from this old season to a new season. And this the same thing occurred during the month as well. The new moon festival was a rite of passage from old month to the new month. Wow, this is not writing good on here. I apologize for that. My thing was kind of acting up there. I don't know why it just zoomed in. Anyway, so we've got the old season, right? You go from planting season, essentially. Wow, this is not letting me draw on the screen. But anyways, you can see here on the screen, we go from the old season, the planting season, to the new season, which would be the harvest season, and then and that's the spring feast, and then the fall feast, we go from the harvest season to then the planting season. And in between, we have this liminal period, where we have rites of separation. That's why you have a Shabbat on the first day, and you have a Shabbat on the last day. And in between, you have a liminal period. And what are we doing during that liminal period? It does not tell us what we're doing. But, I mean, especially for Sukkot, what do? We all go out and we go camping, and during that time, we're studying the Torah together, we're focusing on learning the Torah, and we're essentially going through a trial and testing phase if we're out camping, because most of us don't go camping, or most of us don't live in a tent, is what I mean to say. So it is it's a trial and testing and learning period for, we believe, for the future Exodus. And it's a period, as you can see here, on the screen again, you can see here with this liminal period, it's a time of elevated holiness. You're supposed to be set apart. Because remember, that's what the word holiness means, is set apart. And so during this time, while you are allowed to work, you are supposed to be at this elevated status where you are celebrating the festival and you're doing things that are important for God's kingdom during this time. The other thing we can look at is the sacrificial system itself, actually, especially with the Zevach Shelemim, or the peace offering, as we call it. The peace offering itself was a legal means by which we could approach the Creator. You can look here again on the screen, and what goes on when they the person starts off and they are common, right? They have to be purified, but they are, they have to be in clean status, but they're common status. They slaughter the animal, and then there's this period between when the animal is slaughtered and when the animal sacrifice is fully eaten, that they're in a status, and that was the whole purpose of this peace offering, the Zabach Shelamim, is that it's a time of communion with God. That's why they would actually eat the sacrifice. Usually they would eat it at the tabernacle with the priests, is that it was a big celebration, and you'd fulfilled a vow or something like that, and you were supposed to be there, basically having a party with God, having communion with God. So you're at an elevated holiness status, because that meat is actually, it's no longer that meat, that animal had started off in this common realm here, but when it was ritually slaughtered, that animal moved up to a higher level of holiness. It is now considered most holy, if I remember the terminology right. And then remember what happens. You go and then you can eat it for the first 2 days, but if it's the third day, you can't eat it. What do you have to do with the meat? You have to burn the meat. You have to destroy the meat. And if you don't, it's actually a very, very serious offense. I believe it actually calls for karat, for cutting off it of the person if they fail to burn that meat by that third day. Because that's that period of elevated holiness, and if you allow the meat to go out further than that, you're now contaminating you're placing what is holy with those things that are not holy. And that, I mean, just like when Uzziah reached out and touched the ark and it instantly killed him, you've got interactions like that. Now, not as severe as that, but you've got interactions that are not allowed to occur in the scripture. Things that are set apart cannot come in contact with those things that are defiled. They can't come in contact with each other. So we'll finish up here with just a couple more examples here. We talked about in Numbers 31, right? They went out to this battle. They killed the Midianites who had caused sexual immorality through the camp. And they brought back the women. And Moses is very upset about this, and he actually tells them they go and kill every woman who's ever been with a man. Only the virgins they keep. And even then, after the killing, because they've come in contact with death, they are now defiled. And so now they have to go through a rite of passage to come back to a clean state because they've come in contact with corpses, and corpses give you the highest level of impurity. So they themselves, they have to purify on the first day, the third day, and the seventh day, them and their captives. And their captives essentially are being reincorporated into Israel. And it talks about cutting their hair and stuff. Let me turn here really fast. Numbers 31, verse 12. We can see here that here Moses is wroth with them, says, you slay them and keep them alive, and you camp outside the camp for 7 days. Whoever has slain any being and whoever has touched the slain, cleanse yourself and your captives, right, on the third day and on the seventh day, and cleanse every garment, every leather object of leather, and all that, all this thing. So they cleanse them on the third day and on the seventh day. The same thing with the Nazirite vow. The Nazirite, remember, he has to shave his head. Why is he shaving his head? Because the Nazirite, when he took that vow, he placed himself in an elevated status of holiness. And so at the fulfillment of that, he has to shave his head, and he has to bring a purification offering to purify the everything. And that is to, because he was at a higher level of holiness, and now he has to basically, and I hesitate to use the word, but it's the correct word, he has to decontaminate from holiness, because holiness is contagious. Now, you know, we don't want to think of decontaminate in a bad sense, but he has to remove the holiness from him so that he can now go back into that common life. The bondservant was another excellent example. Remember, if a Hebrew sells himself as a slave, he works for 6 years, and on what, the seventh year, he goes out. And it's kind of interesting because in Mesopotamia, the slaves would have what was called an abutu lock. They would have like a special lock of hair hanging down that showed that they were a slave. And whenever they were freed from slavery, they would actually cut and you can see this in the law codes of Hammurabi and Eshnunah, they would actually cut this lock off, which should imply that this slave was now free. And once again, at the end of, in the Bible, at the end of Exodus 21, verse 2 and 6, that passage there, if he chooses to stay with his master, they drill a hole, they have blood that links him to the doorpost, which is the threshold of that household, right? They're performing a ritual on the threshold again, going into his ear. Quick couple more examples. We've got the parturient, the woman who just gave birth, and now she has to be set apart for 7 days. And then at the end of that, she has to bring a sacrifice. And remember, that sacrifice wasn't because she sinned. The sacrifice was a purification, simply because she was in a state of prolonged ritual defilement. The Passover, the Pesach, remember, if you look at the instructions of the Pesach, it says if a stranger wants to become a native born, if he wants to go through the process of becoming a citizen of Israel, which we do the same thing today, we don't just let people go from being one country and immediately becoming an American citizen. They come over here, and they're essentially in a ger status. They're in a stranger status while they're learning our customs and our laws. And then at the end, if I remember correctly, they actually have to take a test, and then they have to go in and they have to do a ceremony where they swear allegiance to the United States. They're doing a whole rite of passage from being a foreigner to becoming a U.S. citizen. And while they're in America, think about it, while they're in America, during that stranger status, they aren't yet a citizen, but they have the right to be here. They have a permit to be here. And what are they doing? They're learning our customs and ways. So they have a heavy emphasis on our laws because they have to learn our laws. So they're under the law at that point in time. They're being taught by the law how to become a U.S. citizen. And once they become a U.S. citizen, they're not suddenly free from the law, but they're no longer students of the law. They're living life according to the law in America. All right, and I hope you're starting to kind of make the connections here, because we're going to really get hit into this heavy in part 3, coming up with how Paul talks about this, because this is exactly what Paul is talking about. The coronation of kings, whenever a person would go from being a prince to a king, they would do the same thing. And think about David, King David. What happened with him? He, early on, he was anointed with oil, as he was anointed the anointed king, but he didn't become the king that same day. He had to go through a rite of passage where he was transitioning. And this was kind of interesting, because in this story, all the story really is, the main story is during that transition phase, so it's kind of a reverse of what the normal is. But he was anointed. We don't know much about him before. He was anointed. He was separated off from being a shepherd boy. He's now the anointed king. And now he goes through this whole trials and tribulations between him and Saul. And eventually he becomes the king. And there was a coronation. There was a ceremony making him the actual king. So he separated, he transitioned, and he incorporated. And the last example that I want to touch on really quick here is remember when King David, when he slept with Bathsheba, and then he sends off her husband to war, and he dies, and then he's confronted on it, and he's told his son's going to die because that we assume it's his son now, it just says his child. His child falls sick, and He goes into mourning for 7 days. And that was another big thing, these rites of passage. When they would go into mourning, they would go into this transitional state where they, instead of, remember when we talked about earlier, instead of that elevated holiness status, now they go into this lower, they lower their status down into a mourning status. And that's why he wept for 7 days. His son died, and he said, all right, we're done. That's it. We stop at this point. And that brings out a kind of interesting point, because most commonly what they would do during this time of mourning is they would actually, you know, they would actually pull out their hair, and in other cultures, to mourn for the dead, they would actually rip out parts of their beard. And remember, the commandment tells you, and it's funny because Messianics always argue about this without ever looking at the context of what it means. When it says, do not mar the corners of your beard, they have a perfectly good word in Hebrew for shaving, but they did not use it in that verse. They use a different word that means to mar. It means a permanent, basically to permanently damage the corners of your head. Because that's what they would do. They would actually rip that out, and that hair would never grow back. And that was the custom. So when God's telling them, do not mar the corners of your beard, he's not trying to, if he wanted to tell you, the commandment is to wear a beard, there's perfectly good words in Hebrew that could say, it is a commandment to wear a beard. But he didn't say that. He said, don't mar it. Because when you mar it, now you're essentially, you're entering into that mourning phase, that mourning transitional phase, ritual phase, and by pulling that out permanently, you never leave that. You're always in mourning, because you always have that symbol of mourning. And that's why it's always connected in conjunction also with do not make tattoos for the dead. Because you're now, and it's sad because you see this all over the place nowadays. Even in the Christian world, you know, that someone dies and they tattoo the name of the dead person on them. Now you're stuck in that that rite of passage where you're in mourning. And let's go back here. Let's look here on the screen. And I'll just kind of try to draw this on. Hopefully it'll work here. So you can see how we have this elevated status. So essentially what they're doing is they're coming here and they're going down, and then, and this is the normal thing, right? This is normal. You're at a common status. We'll just use C for common here. And over here you're common. And while you're mourning, man, this is not letting me write today. Anyways, you know what I mean. While you're in the status of mourning down here, you're at a reduced status. You know, when you were in that status of mourning, you would have come in contact with the dead, and you would be ritually impure. You would not be able to go into the tabernacle. Now, what happens if you make a mark on yourself, be it ripping out your beard or getting a tattoo? Now you come down here, now you drop down, and you're in the status of mourning, and you just continue to live your life out forevermore in this status of ritual mourning, right? And that's what God's telling you to do. He doesn't want you to go into a permanent status of mourning for the dead, because then you start to go into the whole idea of worshiping the dead, and that was a huge, huge problem in Israel. So I hope you've enjoyed this up to this point. We're going to take a break here, and when we come back in part three, we're going to go heavily in depth into Paul's writings and into some of the other stuff in the New Testament. We're going to be able to finally see and understand what Paul means at certain points in time, and we're going to be able to see what this means to us as believers today, and how we should understand keeping the Torah, why we have certain feelings, why we feel sometimes like we're in a you know, we're in a boat in a sea that's tossing and turning. We just don't know where we're supposed to be at. We don't know who we are. We're going to understand that completely in part three.